Tonight, I'm pleased to welcome Beth Bonner. Beth will discuss the Guam Bird Rescue Project and efforts to save the Guam kingfishers from extinction. And that's a big project. Ms. Bonner is the Animal Collections Manager at the Philadelphia Zoo and the Species Coordinator of the Guam Kingfisher Species Survival Program. And she earned a Bachelor of Science degree in biology from College of William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, and then started her career at the Jacksonville Zoo. And she moved on after that and has been at the Philadelphia Zoo for over 30 years. She's also a member of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Micronesian Kingfisher Recovery Committee and a founding member of the Zoological Registrars Association, and served on the Association of Zoos and Aquariums Wildlife Conservation and Management Committee for 6 years. So please welcome Ms. Beth Bonner, please.
Just this little. Huh. That one looks familiar. So thank you all for coming tonight. I want to thank the staff of the aquarium for inviting me out. This is an amazing opportunity to come out here and speak to people about something that has been a big part of my life for many, many years, more years than I care to admit for a number of reasons. I met Rob at an AZA conference, and he was looking for a species for the Aquarium of the Pacific. And so I said, you're in the right place. I have the species for you. So it's been a very excellent partnership having the aquarium join the program. And I appreciate Dudley showing me around today and Linda taking care of getting me out here. And I'm happy that you all could come to my talk tonight. And I hope you will find it interesting. See if I can get the technology going here. All right. I don't have to point this at anything. It was the heavy silence, a dawn in the tropics without bird sounds, bordered on the surreal. The silence was so complete that it seemed to be audible, and so eerie, I felt like shuddering. There were no more native forest birds in southern Guam. Their last stand was in the northern third of the island. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was already a reality, year-round affair in southern Guam. Extinction was no longer some textbook abstraction here. It was reality, a silent reality. And so began the Guam Bird Rescue Project. Imagine, if you will, a lush tropical forest or garden, so to speak, impacted for all future time by a serpent. No, I am not here to talk about creationism. I am here to tell you about the reality of extinction, something most of us never expect to experience firsthand. Most of you are familiar with the dodo, the quintessential poster child for extinction, and the woolly mammoth, a prehistoric favorite. Fewer, perhaps, the Tasmanian wolf or thylacine. This almost fantastical creature was the largest known carnivorous marsupial lost due to relentless efforts by bounty hunters. For those of us in North America, the most famous extinctions are the passenger pigeon, the last of which Martha died at the Cincinnati Zoo in 1914. And the Carolina parakeet, also last found at the Cincinnati Zoo in 1918. Thankfully, the bald eagle was only a near miss. But how many of you know about the nightingale reed warbler? Or the brindled white eye? Or the Guam broadbill? Oops, what's going on here? Or the rufous-fronted fantail? Four species or subspecies once found only on the island of Guam. Or the cardinal honey eater, Mariana fruit dove, or white-throated ground dove. Of 18 species of native Guamanian birds, 7 are extinct. 2 are extinct in the wild, 6 are rare, and 3 are uncommon. Birds were not the only wildlife impacted. 2 out of 3 native bat species are extinct, and small mammals and reptile fauna were also reduced in numbers. Shrews have virtually disappeared, and 5 native lizard species are now locally extinct. It also caused a cascading ecological effect by removing native pollinators, causing subsequent decline of native plants. Enter the villain in our story. The brown tree snake, Boega irregularis, is a slender climbing snake with large eyes and a vertical pupil, giving it improved nocturnal vision. The species is native to Papua New Guinea, Eastern Indonesia, the Solomon Islands, and eastern and northern coastal Australia. Brown tree snakes are about 15 inches long when they hatch, but may reach a length of 9 feet. Typically, they are 3 to 6 feet. They are adept climbers and can crawl through very small openings. Boega irregularis is a rear-fanged and mildly poisonous. The brown tree snake will strike readily when aggravated, but does not present a danger to adults. Both constriction and venom are used to help immobilize prey, and babies, human babies, less than 6 months old may be at risk from both the brown tree snake bite and constriction. So far, what I've presented is a lot of doom and gloom, but what I really want to talk about today is an opportunity, a chance to put right an environmental disaster that beset the island of Guam during our lifetime, a plan to save a species through partnerships, all of which play a critical role in the recovery of the Guam Micronesian kingfisher. Totorhamphus cinnamomenus, or CHEC, as it is known in the native Chamorro language. And I want to clarify a little bit about the taxonomy of this species, because you may see different things over time if you've watched the program at all. When the program originally started, the Guam kingfisher was a subspecies of the Micronesian kingfisher. Its scientific name was Halcyon cinnamomena cinnamomena. Over time, the taxonomists got a hold of this and decided to change the classification and put it in the genus Totorhamphus, which distressed me to no end because Halcyon is such a beautiful word. Anyway, and then more recently, it was elevated to a full species level. So it is no longer a subspecies. It is now the full species, the Guam Micronesian kingfisher. We're transitioning from Micronesian kingfisher to Guam kingfisher, so you may hear me use them interchangeably. The Guam Bird Rescue Project started out with a chance encounter between wildlife biologist Bob Beck, who was working for the Guam Division of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources, DAR, and Larry Shelton, who was then the curator of birds at the Philadelphia Zoo. They met at an avian conservation meeting in 1983. This partnership was quickly expanded to include curators at both the National and Bronx Zoos, as well as the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. People started noticing birds disappearing from the central part of the island around the Apra Harbor area sometime in the 1950s. The decline spread to the east. By the end of the 1960s, the birds in the southern part of Guam had also declined noticeably. The decline spread to the northern parts of the island through the 1970s and early 80s. Researchers with the Guam Division of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service were still trying to figure out the cause of the decline in the early 80s when it became clear that the island's endemics, birds that occur only on the island of Guam, would soon go extinct. Bob Beck reached out to AZA community, and the decision was made to establish captive populations of 5 endemic island birds. Unfortunately, by the time the rescue got underway, only the Guam rail and the Guam kingfisher remained in sufficient numbers. It wasn't until 1983 that wildlife biologists on Guam identified the brown tree snake, an invasive species, as the probable culprit, after ruling out avian disease, pesticides, and habitat destruction. The egg and bird-eating snake, arboreal snake, is thought to have arrived in Guam in the late 1940s, when the Mariana Islands became an important operations base for the U.S. military during World War II. When the Marianas were taken over by the Allies, military equipment was moved to Guam from the former base of operations in Papua New Guinea. where the brown tree snake is native. It is believed that the snake arrived as a stowaway on these military transports and was introduced to Guam from ships using the Apra Harbor. The noted spread of the snake through Guam, first east, then south, and finally to the north of the island, closely matched the pattern of avian decline. What a surprise. The Philadelphia Zoo took the lead on the Guam kingfisher and the Smithsonian National Zoo on the Guam rail. A total of 29 kingfishers were captured on Guam between 1984 and 1986. A total of 22 Guam rails were rescued and formed the basis for that breeding program. As it turned out, Guam rails were easily propagated, and the captive population grew quickly due to large clutches, 1 to 5 eggs, and the ability to re-nest within 30 days of a successful clutch. The birds are also sexually mature at 5 to 6 months of age. As a result, by 1989, Guam rails were being released on the nearby snake-free island of Rota. Although the kingfisher breeding program got off to a quick start with the first successful captive hatch occurring in 1985 and the first second generation hatch in 1988, growing the population for recovery turned out to be a long and painstaking process. Step one was the compilation of data into a stud book. A stud book is basically the tool we use to manage captive populations. It contains information on every bird in the population, usually for a particular species, and that data is then used by other programs to do the analysis needed for population management. By the time that the first stud book was published in 1988, and I became the stud book keeper, since all the birds had come through the Philadelphia Zoo, I already had access to all of their records, the program was well on its way. And in 1989, the rescue evolved into a species survival program. AZA's flagship cooperative breeding and conservation program for selected species in zoos and aquariums in North America. SSPs manage the breeding of species through master planning process in order to maintain a healthy and self-sustaining captive population that is both genetically diverse and demographically stable. Larry Shelton, then at the Houston Zoo, served as the first species coordinator until he left the zoo field in 1990, at which point I took over as species coordinator as well as stud book keeper. As the SSP developed, we added scientific advisors in specialty areas to help guide the program. This included nutrition, veterinary medicine, and pathology. It was the winter of 1991 when the Guam Kingfisher program entered a 10-year period of reproductive stasis. This was the result of a perverse balance between reproductive success and high mortality in young adult birds, typically aged 2 to 4 years, birds that should have been forming the basis of the next generation. To this point, reproduction had been steady but slow. Unlike the rails, kingfishers only produce 1 to 3 eggs per clutch, typically 2. And for still unknown reasons, they will only raise a single chick. If there are 2 fertile eggs in a nest, one has to be hand-raised to achieve 100% viability, assuming the parents are also successful. The disappearance of chicks in the nest has been a problem from the beginning and was originally attributed to neonates looking so much like the pink mice that are part of their diet. We've since determined that probably what was happening, rather than cannibalism, which is what we called it at the time, was that the chicks were not surviving for some unknown reason and were essentially being nest cleaned, rather than this kind of more morbid dining on their offspring. Sexual maturity is achieved at 11 to 13 months. So compared to the rails, this slowed generation time as well. Although this period of high mortality could never be attributed to any specific medical or disease issue, the only thing that changed was the availability of lizards, a mainstay for this carnivorous bird's diet. A freeze in the southeast during the winter of 91-92 resulted in lizards becoming unavailable. As a result, zoos were forced to make dietary substitutions. Although the lizard shortage was temporary, most zoos saw the dietary transition as an opportunity to save financially, as lizards are very expensive by comparison. Although somewhat anecdotal, it is believed, based on later nutritional analyses, that the lack of adult lizards in the diet ultimately compromised the young birds. The lizardless diet was adequate to sustain life, but may not have provided important nutrients such as carotenoids, antioxidants, which are thought to provide health benefits. Ultimately, this may have negatively impacted the bird's resistance to disease and other environmental factors, including stress, resulting in the increased mortality. Another modification was made during this period in an attempt to address concerns about stress in young adults. This is what you do when you can't find a cause of mortality, blame it on stress. Stress has a lot of impact, and you can't always see it in a normal necropsy process. Typically, captive birds were moved to new locations for pairing when they reached sexual maturity. But a hypothesis was put forth suggesting that maybe for this species, putting birds in a breeding situation that young could result in increased stress, ultimately compromising health. Having nothing to lose, we pushed the age of transfer closer to 2 years and believe this strategy, along with a return to a lizard-based diet, contributed to improved longevity. By 2004, the population was showing a significant upturn. Since the establishment of the AZA's Micronesian Kingfisher Species Survival Plan, or SSP, it has set its sights on growing the population for the purpose of reestablishing a population on Guam. Because birds were all but eradicated on the island when the rescue began, there was no real opportunity to study their biology or behavior before embarking on the development of a zoo breeding program. As a result, our successes are amazing. Over the course of 30 years, a significant amount of research has been done to better understand the species and its needs. Partners in the captive breeding effort have included 33 AZA zoos and aquariums, Guam's Division of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources, the AZA's Population Management Center at Lincoln Park Zoo, as well as academic researchers from Oregon State University, Pomona College, University of Central Florida, and University of Missouri, Columbia. In 1995, a Micronesian Kingfisher Action Plan meeting was convened, bringing together key people from the zoological and conservation communities, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Guam Division of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources to address concerns related to the recovery and encourage increased action by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The end product of this meeting was a document designed to provide a blueprint for conservation action in the areas of husbandry, veterinary medicine, reproductive biology, reintroduction, and administration. Husbandry concerns at the time included inconsistent breeding. We had pairs that we considered socially compatible or platonic versus sexually compatible. So we had birds that would live together for extended periods of time and never reproduce. We had loss of parent-reared chicks. As I described, the chicks disappeared in the nest. We weren't really sure what was happening. Nest log quality is a big issue for this species. They excavate their nest cavities in logs. Typically on Guam, there were several species of trees that would be damaged by storms and become soft and very appropriate for the birds to excavate. Finding those types of logs in our captive breeding program was difficult, especially for those of us in the Northeast. And we actually even imported palm logs from a zoo in Florida in an attempt to replicate appropriate nest logs. Egg infertility, always a problem when you're dealing with birds. If the eggs aren't fertile, something's not right. Nutrition, we had very limited options with this species based on what we knew in the wild. They ate insects, crustaceans, and lizards. And then disease issues. Although we haven't had any specific problem with diseases other than some kind of reproductive anomalies, mycobacteriosis has been a problem, and we think these birds are more susceptible to it than many other species. Highlighted research efforts have included a data analysis project. The Philadelphia Zoo hired a postdoc to come and look at 10 years worth of Micronesian kingfisher data that I'd been collecting to try to determine if there's any husbandry issues that we could address by have a better understanding of what's actually happening with the birds. So this research associate looked at all the data, visited all the facilities that were currently involved in the program, and then worked to compile this information into a husbandry manual. This is kind of the cookbook, the how to take care of Micronesian kingfishers. We looked at things such as seasonality of pair bonding and actually found that birds that were introduced later in the season rather than prior to the breeding season were more likely to breed quickly. We looked at hand rearing. Was there any impact of hand rearing on later reproduction and found no significant issues? We looked at methods for evaluating these platonic pairs. There was this ongoing process of, well, they didn't breed this year, but certainly next year they're going to breed. So we don't want to split them up. We want to keep this going. And we looked at ways to recognize these platonic pairs sooner rather than later. More recently, we've had issues with aggressive pairs, which really didn't exist in the early phases of the program. And so that's something new we're going to have to look at. Why are we seeing aggression? Nutrition. A lot of work was done on nutrition, analyzing different food items, bringing in lizards from Guam to look at the nutritional basis for those items that the birds were eating in the wild. Veterinarians in North American zoos and aquariums are very hesitant to try things that are a little risky because you don't want to end up poisoning the birds, for example, feeding them frogs or something that could end up being toxic to the birds. So we have a very limited variety of food items that people are willing to test on the kingfishers. There were attempts to develop a formulated diet because one of the concerns is if they're not getting nutrition from the more natural foods that we're feeding them, maybe we can put something into a pellet and get them to eat that. They were not willing to eat pellets. They were also not willing to eat the gel gummy lizards that we made for them. So all in all, they've been very uncooperative and they like to eat what they like to eat. Behavioral ecology of the species. Because we couldn't study the Guam subspecies of, or species of kingfishers, we actually had a researcher from Oregon State who went to Ponape and looked at one of the other subspecies, the Ponape Micronesian kingfisher, and did a study of that species in an effort to try to learn more about the behavioral ecology that we could then apply that to the birds from Guam. And he did come back with some very useful information related to mate choice, you know, certain things that helped us determine that females are more likely to select the mate based on his habitat and his environment. Information about nest preference. And he also brought back information to suggest that at least for this subspecies, that young kingfishers actually stay in the territory and serve as helpers at the nest. We haven't been able, I don't know if that applies to the Guam birds, but we have not been able to replicate that in captivity because the spaces that we have for these birds are typically not large enough and they're very territorial birds. We talked about stress. So an effort was made to study stress hormones, corticosteroids in Guam kingfishers quite a number of years ago now. And at that time, the only way to analyze these hormones was to collect blood, which we really didn't want to be taking blood from kingfishers on a regular basis, or to look at fecal analysis. Also difficult because unless you have someone watching to know who goes where, you really can't assign that hormone result to any particular bird. More recently, a grad student at the University of Missouri-Columbia has been working on some new technology that allows them to look at corticosteroids taken from feathers. So for the past year, zoos participating in this program have been sending him feathers to help look at stress in the birds in the current captive population. So this will definitely be a simpler and more informational process than the methods we were using before. And in 2001, we held a husbandry workshop, and this was really a great opportunity to bring together keepers, which for the most part have not kind of been involved in the program, so the people that are actually taking care of the birds, keepers, curators, program managers, program advisors, researchers from the field, all came together, including some of the people from Guam who took care of the Guam rail, but they had never even seen a Micronesian kingfisher because they were extinct before they were born, came to this workshop. And we had round tables and discussions and presentations and really got everyone on board with best husbandry protocols for the Guam kingfisher. Since that time, a couple of other research projects have resulted in the development of some artificial nest boxes. As I said before, the nest log issue has been a problem, and people have been always looking for creative ways to provide the birds with alternatives to nest logs. And one of them that came about fairly recently is using nest boxes or nest blocks made of decoy cork. One of the zoos discovered that the kingfishers could easily excavate the decoy cork boxes. It wasn't too soft and it wasn't too hard, and it actually has worked quite well in a number of zoos, including the aquarium, are using this method to provide alternatives to the traditional nest log. Thermal characteristics. Dylan Kessler, who's at University of Missouri Columbia, did a project looking at temperatures in the facilities that currently house Micronesian kingfishers, comparing it to the temperatures on Guam. And we found that for the most part, across the board, zoos in North America, even in the southern climes and other areas, do not have the humidity and the high temperatures that are found on Guam. So to some extent, we are not keeping these birds at their natural optimum temperatures. And unfortunately, that's kind of difficult to control. We've also looked at population genetics, and most recently, the student from Missouri has looked at, repeated the data study that was done and looked at, visited all the facilities and collected information to look at how we can best optimize husbandry. What things that some zoos are doing that are succeeding and what things that don't seem to be working at other facilities, all with an effort to maximize our reproduction. Now, while zoos were focused on captive propagation, teams from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Wildlife Services, and U.S. Geological Survey were focused on controlling the brown tree snake. Obviously, this is a two-part project. We're producing birds, but until those snakes are gone, reintroduction is not an option. So while they're trying to control the snake, and even more importantly, preventing its spread to other islands, fences, traps, snake search dogs, and collection bounties are among the methods that have been used to reduce and control the population of snake. Basically, removal or exclusion seem to be our only options. Despite best efforts, the species persists on Guam, though they are now smaller in length and girth. And unfortunately, encounter reports have come from Micronesia, other islands in the Northern Mariana chain, Hawaii, and even the United States. Other than Guam, Saipan is the only other island where reproduction has been reported. Current control techniques include trapping and experimental use of acetaminophen-laden mice dropping from the sky. The aerial delivery of toxicants is used for brown tree snakes in non-residential, large-scale, difficult-to-reach areas. The flags have two cardboard ends with 4 feet of flagging in between. A pink mouse, stuffed with a Tylenol tablet, is attached to one end. The rest of the flag is designed to hang the device in the trees to avoid non-targets taking the bait. This entire project is the result of many years of research for each aspect of the procedure, and a lot of approvals were required to get this instigated. The last stage is automatizing the delivery system, which will save time, increase efficiency, and reduce costs. The impact of this species goes well beyond the decimation of Guam's wildlife. Human health concerns were generally low because of the rear fang snake. The rear fang colubrid is only mildly venomous, however potentially harmful to infants and small children and pets. Economically, the snake created serious problems by causing power outages, generally also to the detriment of the snake. Estimated costs due to direct damages and lost productivity were estimated at $1 to $4 million a year back in 2001. There was also risk to the tourist industry due to fear generated by stories of the brown tree snake. In the mid-1990s, my daughter's Weekly Reader included an article suggesting that the snakes hung from trees like spaghetti. I was actually happened to be on Guam when she got that weekly reader, and talking to her on the phone, she asked me if it was true. That is now described as a myth. At peak density, the snake was estimated at 6 to 8 snakes per acre, but that's still a lot of snakes, and especially when they were at their largest size. The Guam kingfisher and 4 other species, 2 of which are now extinct, were listed as endangered under the U.S. Endangered Species Act in 1984. A recovery plan covering all 5 species was published in 1990, though it wasn't until 2001 that a recovery committee was formed to address programmatic needs for the kingfisher. Despite developing an action-based 5-year timeline, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Committee became effectively inactive in 2003, following its 3rd meeting. Critical habitat was designated in 2004, but it is believed to be insufficient for long-term recovery based on our understanding of habitat and territory requirements. You can see the birds typically require 25 acres for their territory. That's a lot of space. And although the original allocation for critical habitat was a pretty good number, it was reduced significantly to the point where it would accommodate about 15 birds. Some of the most desirable habitat on Guam is already impacted by the U.S. military presence on Guam. And now the DOD is transferring their marine base from Okinawa to Guam. In 2008, a revised recovery plan was published for the kingfisher alone. This plan designated the kingfisher as recovery priority 6 on a scale of 1, being the highest, to 18, reflecting a high degree of threat and a relatively low prospects for recovery. Listed recovery actions focus on increasing the size of the captive population, controlling the brown tree snake, protecting and enhancing habitat for reintroduction, and reintroducing the kingfisher to Guam. Have a drum roll here. The total estimated cost of recovery at that time was reported as almost $146 million over an estimated 50-year period, with approximately $39 million required during the first 5 years of recovery implementation. What the plan doesn't address, and to me is kind of a neonate in this process, was total surprise, the fact that the money does not exist to fund a recovery plan. I kind of thought if you have a recovery plan, that means that the money comes with it. Apparently not. But I want you to keep these numbers in mind because they are actually kind of reminiscent of the famed $435 hammer. During the period that the recovery committee was on hiatus, the SSP zoos continued to breed. Our success resulted in the first return of kingfishers to Guam in 2003 to establish a captive breeding population in the species' natural environment. We kind of hoped getting them back to Guam might help us address some of the husbandry issues we were facing in the mainland. 3 additional translocations followed. Breeding success came quickly in the large aviaries constructed by the DARF staff. And they are currently holding 14 birds. Continued improvements in husbandry on the mainland resulted in a rapid increase in numbers and the need to recruit additional zoos and aquariums. Aquarium of the Pacific joined the program in the fall of 2010. And it's thanks to a staff campaign that the nice kingfisher facility that you see here at the aquarium was constructed. 2 additional facilities have come on board since, and 2 are awaiting designation of birds. But this doesn't come close to the capacity requirements for long-term growth. Finally, in November of 2013, with the SSP facing serious space challenges that could ultimately cause the managed population to crash, thereby crippling the recovery effort, the Fish and Wildlife Service responded by resuscitating the Recovery Committee, a modified version. The committee identified a critical goal of getting a population of kingfishers established in the wild within 5 years, That would be 2019. This time, we have functioned through a monthly conference calls and have developed a release plan to inform strategic planning and funding. Because the brown tree snake is still omnipresent on Guam and availability of habitat currently in question, the committee has recommended that we opt for a strategy described as assisted colonization. This is a wildlife management technique whereby individuals are intentionally relocated to places outside their native range in an effort to protect them. More commonly, protection from climate change may be a basis for this type of action. In the case of the Guam kingfisher, the intent would be to establish a wild population supported by captive breeding until such time as this new population can both sustain itself and a translocation or reintroduction on Guam. At present, this is the only hope for the return of birds to Guam. Establishing a wild population of kingfishers will allow for unrestricted population growth and provide for the time needed to control brown tree snakes and perform essential assessments of habitat on Guam. In retrospect, it is clear that the Fish and Wildlife Service should have treated this component of the recovery plan as a much higher priority during the 30 years since listing. So where should we establish this haven for Guam kingfishers? Logistically, the best choice would be another island in the Mariana chain. However, evaluation of these islands found them not well suited due to habitat type, existence of a competitor kingfisher species, and introduced species. An investigation of over 30,000 possible islands was undertaken by Dr. Dylan Kessler and grad student Rebecca Laws, both University of Missouri Columbia, and funded by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Once island characteristics with the potential to affect successful establishment, and there's a lot of choices, of the Guam kingfisher were identified, a complex analysis, even more complex than this graph, known as a Bayesian network model, was constructed to calculate the probability that an island would be a suitable translocation site for Guam kingfishers. So they looked at all the characteristics, looked at the characteristics of the island, and were able to identify which islands might be suited. The candidate islands included the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, the Federated States of Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, and Samoa. Among other things, characteristics included climate and temperature, habitat, availability of nest materials, predators, competitors, effects on other species, presence of food items, logistical and operational infrastructure. Those are just some of the key critical issues, but obviously there are many more to look at. And if you've got a computer doing the modeling for you, you can look at all of that stuff. Starting with 30,000 islands, 1,322 existed with good information. 334 of those had U.S. ties, but only 5 islands were selected by the model. All in Micronesia. We have Yap, the Fechuk Islands, Waino and Fefan, and Kosrae. Kosrae is a single large island which offers the most high quality habitat and is the only island that could potentially support a target population greater than 2,000 individuals. Preliminary discussions with the FSM government suggest there is interest in supporting this program, and Kosrae also has a strong NGO base, including the Nature Conservancy, Kosrae Conservation and Safety Organization, and the Micronesian Conservation Trust. The next steps for the recovery committee are to develop a proposal to begin evaluation for release on Kosrae. This will include a survey of lizard data from Guam, one or more of the CNMI islands, and Kosrae to compare prey density. It will be combined with a bird point count and vegetation surveys from Kosrae to aid in environmental evaluation of the impact of releasing Guam kingfishers. It's not all about the kingfisher, unfortunately. We have to look at the impact in the local release area as well. To support the planned release, we will need to significantly increase the population. which currently hovers around 150 birds and 55 pairs. We would like to have a minimum base of 200 birds before starting to harvest for release. With good management, we feel we should be able to increase the population by 50 to 100 birds per season if we have a place to hold the offspring. To this end, the Fish and Wildlife Service has allocated $40,000 from discretionary funds, so it wasn't budgeted, to support development of an expansion facility. The Brookfield Zoo offered up space in a former education building that could accommodate up to 30 enclosures if outfitted with lighting and electric. The current grant will get the ball rolling with 10 cages plus lighting and electric and support care and feeding for up to 5 birds for 1 year. Additional funds contributed by Guam Division of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources will feed and care for another 5 birds, basically giving us 10 birds for this current year. To maximize the facility, we will need to find funding for 20 additional enclosures and support to care and feed for the additional birds. While caging is a one-time cost, the support must be funded annually. Brookfield's provision of space is contingent on the Fish and Wildlife Service moving forward with the release, as this can only be handled, as this can only be a short-term fix, both logistically and financially. Over the years, there's been talk about building a dedicated Guam breeding holding facility. But at this point in the game, it makes the most sense to invest funding directly into getting birds back in the wild. Clearly, we need some big money to keep the program going and establish a wild population, and we have no time to waste. Each year that we limit breeding means loss of numbers and, more critically, loss of gene diversity. So how is it that hundreds of millions of dollars are spent on endangered species recovery plans every year? Yet the Guam kingfisher, one of the world's most endangered species, has been the recipient of less than $150,000 over 30 years. How is it that the Department of Defense, which continues to impact habitat for endangered species on Guam, has yet to provide any support for these programs, though there is some hope on the horizon? While there have been many partners in the effort to save the Guam kingfisher, we are missing those with deep pockets. We are missing those whose participation can make the difference. The preliminary budget for the current release plan is only $4 million over 7 years. And after we're talking about $139 million, $146 million, four sounds like a very small number. This is a drop in the bucket to what has been sent on similar recovery programs and a far cry from the $146 million over 50 years proposed in 2008. Over the course of the past 30 years, I have many times cautioned that each new year could be the last for this species. With a small population, you are always living on the edge. We have gone through periods of great momentum and periods of what might be called programmatic apathy. In effect, while waiting for the population to grow large enough for reintroduction, recovery plan action steps were put on the back burner. Certainly, lack of funding has contributed to this malaise, and the fact that the kingfisher falls under the umbrella of the U.S. Pacific Island ecoregion, which includes Hawaii, means that competition for endangered species dollars to support recovery is stiff. That said, thanks to the work of AZA zoos and aquariums that have remained committed to this effort, 13 for more than 25 years, the passion of the Division of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources staff, and the determination of Dr. Dylan Kessler, University of Missouri Columbia, and Dr. Susan Haig, Oregon State, both of whom have devoted their academic careers to supporting the recovery of the Guam kingfisher, we are at a point, having a population with the potential to grow exponentially and a release plan in hand, that there is nothing holding us back except the funding. From the very first partnership between Bob Beck, Division of Aquatic and Wildlife Resources, and Larry Shelton at the Philadelphia Zoo, we have seen this program grow to one of the most unique conservation opportunities to challenge modern zoos and aquariums. Rarely has an avicultural conservation opportunity Rarely has an avicultural project demonstrated such a degree of cooperation between zoos and aquariums, agencies, government agencies, academic institutions, and NGOs. Techniques developed in this program not only put us in a position to prevent the extinction of the Guam rail and the Guam kingfisher, but will also provide protocols and valuable experience for other species in similar situations. In retrospect, there are some lessons learned. Number one, establish a scientific approach to management, especially important for species where little is known. Early success is not a reliable predictor of long-term success. Behavioral observation and documentation of management strategies must begin at onset and continue until program goals are achieved. Field studies must be an integral part of every captive management program. A thorough understanding of behavioral ecology will certainly increase the likelihood of success over the long term. Establish cooperative affiliations with all appropriate government agencies. Clear lines of responsibility should be delineated in areas of management, financial support, and programmatic review. In addition to program goals, there should be guidelines for termination of a program. Although subject to change, benchmarks should be established at the onset of program to allow for ongoing evaluation and clear understanding of program status. There were many times that I wondered if zoos and aquariums were struggling to maintain a population for recovery plan long ago abandoned. Following the 1995 Action Plan meeting, an article by Mark Jaffe, author of And No Birds Sing, which chronicles the early years of the Guam bird rescue story, appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer. It summarized the meeting and expressed continued concern for the survival of the species. In response, I received a phone call from a man in the Philadelphia area who had read the article and wanted to help. He offered a commitment of time to care for the birds, and he offered to construct facilities in which to house them. To help save the Micronesian kingfisher, he offered me his backyard. What this says to me is there are probably more partners out there wanting to help, and hopefully we'll find one or more, be it corporate, private, or government, to help us fund a phased release program whereby birds can adapt to life in the wild, grow in numbers, and ultimately be reestablished on Guam. It is time to set the Guam kingfisher free. Thank you.